All right, we're going to continue talking about the molecular mechanisms of some of the big processes in genetics. Today we're going to talk about transcription. And when I talk about gene expression, transcription is an essential part. So we'll talk about the mechanism today, but then later in the semester we'll come back and we'll visit a few times how gene expression is regulated, and much of that happens at the level of transcription. So today you're getting sort of the basic nuts and bolts of how transcription happens, DNA structure. We'll focus on just a few types of DNA, but you'll see there's quite a few types of DNA, of RNA. So just a review of RNA, the structure. We focused more on DNA lately, but the primary structure of RNA, it looks very similar to the one that you saw with DNA. The thing to keep in mind, most of you got this on the homework, that coming off of carbon 2, if it's RNA, that there will be an hydroxyl group off of that position. And then another big difference is the presence of uracil as a base substituting for thymine that you would find in DNA. We're looking at uracil. And RNA exists primarily as a single-stranded molecule. Okay. So big differences between RNA and DNA. The pentose is different. It's ribose versus deoxyribose. That the possible bases coming off of them are slightly different, thymine versus uracil. RNA is typically a single-stranded molecule, while DNA is typically two complementary strands. And that makes DNA a more stable molecule, better for long-term storage of information. Okay. But you've got all of these reactive polar bases that are coming off, and they want to interact with each other. So what happens is you can have a primary structure with just a sequence of an RNA molecule, and they will tend to fold up on themselves and make secondary structures where they make stem loops, where you'll get runs of complementary sequences that will anneal to each other and form these stem loops, and you combine those. But one of the things that's tough, and it's especially important when we start talking about translation and transfer RNA, you're looking at this either in a textbook or on a computer screen or on a projection screen. And so it's really easy to imagine this folding up happening in two dimensions, but it happens in three dimensions as well. So RNA takes on a specific three-dimensional shape based on complementary base pairing in the physiological conditions. Okay? Much like a protein does, if you put the same RNA molecule under the same physiological conditions, it will assume a constant three-dimensional shape. All right, there's all kinds of classes of RNA. We'll talk about a few of them here. Some of the others, if you take molecular biology with Dr. Larson, he talks about some of the others. I think Edwards in cell biology talks about some of them. The main ones that we'll focus on in here, the three big ones, are ribosomal RNA, messenger RNA, and transfer RNA. These are the three main RNA components in gene expression and producing a protein. And specifically, their roles, we'll talk about ribosomes. Ribosomes are the cell structures that facilitate synthesizing proteins. And ribosomes are made up of small proteins and ribosomal RNA molecules. Messenger RNA is the blueprint by which proteins are assembled. It's got the biological information needed to put the correct amino acid at the correct position in a protein. When we talk about gene expression that produces a protein, what we're really talking about is the production of messenger RNA. And you can increase the amount of protein produced by increasing the amount of messenger RNA produced. So think in terms of the messenger RNA as the information or blueprint needed to produce a protein. And transfer RNA. So we've got the ribosome. It synthesizes the protein. We've got the blueprint In messenger RNA, transfer RNA brings the raw materials needed. And so transfer RNA brings the appropriate amino acid needed for protein synthesis. Okay. And so these first three, all involved in protein synthesis one way or another. Then you've got SNRPs and small nuclear RNAs. We're not really going to get into those that much in this class. But the other ones that we'll talk about a little bit down the road are microRNAs and small interfering RNAs. That these are relatively recent molecules in terms of scientists beginning to understand what their role is within cells. Really, 10 years ago, if we were talking about cell biology or genetics, we would have stopped at these three types of RNA molecules, unless we were in a very specific graduate-level class. MicroRNAs and small interfering RNAs have the ability to quench gene expression. So one thing to keep in mind, cells have to be exquisitely efficient, that there's not much long-term survival for cells that waste much energy. If you need to express a gene for a short period of time, you turn on the gene expression. You can turn it off so you're not making any new messenger RNA. But if you still don't need to make more of that protein and you've got messenger RNA floating around, you're going to waste energy making extra protein that's not needed. So these RNA molecules, microRNAs, small interfering RNAs, are involved in reducing the amount of unneeded messenger RNA within a cell. So not only do you stop making new RNA, you chew up the old RNA that you don't need anymore. And we'll talk about those processes later in the term. All right, so just a reminder here. We talked about DNA replication the other day, so I want to make sure that you guys are keeping these processes clear. When we make or when we undergo replication, we're producing a complementary molecule that's DNA. Okay? When we do transcription, it's very much the same. We're going to make a complementary molecule to a strand of DNA, but in transcription, the molecule we're producing is RNA. Okay? And so what happens is DNA is the will serve as the template again. One of the things that happens in a genetics class is that the word gene can take on different meanings. I've got a colleague, he's got a joint appointment in philosophy and biology, Chris Horvath, and he did an entire seminar one time on what's a valid definition for a gene. Remember, Mendel had an idea of a gene is it's something that results in a trait that he could see with his visible eye. But if you talk to a cell molecular biologist, our definition of gene tends to be pretty discrete, and that is a gene is a segment of DNA that's used to transcribe an RNA molecule. Okay? So when we talk in terms of genes now, when we're looking at things at the molecular level, a gene is a segment of DNA that will be transcribed, producing an RNA molecule. So we'll have expression of a gene. It will be transcribed. That will produce an RNA molecule. And then if it's a messenger RNA molecule, that will be used as a blueprint to produce a protein. The vast majority of the gene expression stories that we'll be talking about in here, this will be the story, that the RNA will be a messenger RNA that will be used to produce a protein. Okay? Remember, there are all those other classes of RNAs. They have different functions, but we're really interested at this level in the expression of a protein. That protein has a cellular function that produces a trait that maybe Mendel could have seen, maybe he couldn't have seen it. So our level of detection of the activity of a gene is much more sophisticated, and we can pick up more subtle changes in a cell than Mendel could back in his day. So in replication, the enzyme that's the key is DNA polymerase. With transcription, the enzyme that's the big player is RNA polymerase. We're We've got ACE here, suggesting it's an enzyme. We're still polymerizing something, and now we're polymerizing RNA. Okay? The DNA or RNA up front is telling you the molecule that's being made, not the molecule that's being read. Okay? Both the full terms, we kind of shorten the names of these enzymes. The technical name of these enzymes are, for replication, DNA-dependent DNA polymerase. For transcription, it's DNA-dependent RNA polymerase. Okay, and the DNA-dependent is telling you that these things just don't make an RNA molecule on their own. You have to provide them with a template molecule that they'll read, and the template is DNA. Okay. If you take a microbiology class, or we may have a RNA class coming online in the future, some viruses produce an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So they can make RNA, and the template for them is an RNA strand. We talked about how viruses can have an RNA genome. If you come in and as a virus, if you've got an RNA genome, eukaryotic cells don't have an enzyme that will read RNA and produce another molecule from it. So if you're an RNA virus, you're going to produce your own genome, you either have to convert it to DNA or you have to synthesize RNA yourself. So that would involve an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. For your cells, we're talking about a DNA-dependent RNA polymerase. They will read DNA template and synthesize RNA. And again, it will do it by that complementary base pairing. Even though we've got slightly different structures on the pentoses, even though we've replaced uracil in place of thymine in RNA, we can still do complementary base pairing. And so just as a reminder, okay, so normally in DNA, you would have AT, GC. In RNA, you can have AU and GC. And so those complementary bases will be the mechanism by which the RNA polymerase can carry out its job. All right. When we talked about replication, pointed out that the strand of DNA that was being read is the template strand. That's the DNA strand on which the enzyme binds. That's true in transcription as well. The RNA polymerase molecule will bind to one strand of DNA, and it will produce an RNA molecule which resembles that complementary strand of DNA that was annealed to it. Let's see if we've got a better picture. Nope. All right, so if we've got double-stranded DNA, I won't put helices in this one. Let's see. Okay, and we've got 5 prime, 3 prime, 5 prime, 3 prime. Nucleic acids will always be assembled growing at the 3 prime end. So just like DNA the other day, the new RNA molecule will grow at the 3 prime end, so it will be synthesized in a 5 prime to 3 prime direction. That means that the RNA polymerase is moving along the template strand 3 prime to 5 prime. Okay? So when we talk about RNA polymerase, these strands would be separated. Okay, this strand is our template. Okay. And RNA polymerase binds, it goes through, it moves 3 prime to 5 prime, and it produces a new RNA molecule in a 5 prime to 3 prime orientation with the newest nucleotide is always at the 3 prime end. Okay. We'll talk about that a little bit more, but the RNA molecule that's produced, it doesn't line up with the DNA strand, but if we just took the RNA molecule that was produced and we immediately set it down next to the DNA strand, if we had OK, Okay, if we had a sequence like this, GC, AT, CAT, the complementary sequences up here on this strand, okay, would be CGT, AGTA. Hopefully you can see that. If we look at the RNA molecule that we just produced, it would be, here would be the 5' end. Okay. It would be complementary to these nucleotides that are on the template strand, but the sequence itself would look just like the sequence of the non-template strand, except you just swap out T's on the DNA with U's for the RNA. So as a result, if I give you a DNA sequence, okay, and it's the way that we give you a DNA sequence, remember, is the 5' to 3', we typically show the sequence of the non-template strand. Okay? The template strand is the one that does all the work. The enzyme binds to it. It uses that information. But it uses that template strand to produce an RNA molecule whose information is essentially identical to that of the template or the non-template strand. So that's why if we show you a DNA sequence of a gene, we show you the non-template strand, because you could use that and predict what the RNA sequence is going to be much easier. Okay? So depending on different textbooks and actually in the School of Biological Sciences, different faculty members use that terminology different. I've got one colleague that describes this as a template strand, but this is the one that the enzyme reads. Yep.
On a test, will you tell us, or is it always going to be the non-template?
I will tell you in a test, or I will give you a double-stranded molecule and indicate out to the side a T for the template strand. So you'll have the information that you'll need. You won't have to do both strands to figure out what's going on. I'll let you know which strand is either the template or non-template. Anything else? And you guys are going to see a lot of homework problems on transcription, because it's one of the things that I was kind of surprised the first time that I taught genetics was how much students struggled with it, as, you know, especially if I give them the information. So you'll have the homework that you'll have due for Thursday just on transcription. I will give you one of those problems where I'm telling you which one's the template strand, the non-template strand, and then you just have to write out the sequence of an RNA molecule produced. And then after we get to translation, you'll have a problem where you will have to couple transcription and translation. I will give you the DNA sequence. You have to tell me what the RNA is going to be, and then you'll use information that I give you to tell me what the sequence of the protein would be. And if you're not getting the transcription right, then you run into problems. So you'll be seeing a lot of transcription problems. 50 to 60% of you, it's softball. You'll figure this out. You can do the complementary base pairing. You'll learn how to predict when transcription is starting or at what position it's starting. You'll figure out where it's stopping, and it'll just be a point grab for you. For 40% of you guys, I'm not exactly sure why. For some reason, it doesn't matter how many times I tell students in the class, you will start at the end of the molecule. Even if I tell you don't start at the end of the molecule, and then when it comes time for translation, you'll just start counting in by threes and you'll get something entirely wrong. The next few lectures, I will tell you what RNA polymerase looks for and where it decides to start transcription, and then when we get to translation, I'll let you know what ribosomes look for, but they're not the ends of molecules. Okay? That's a tip. A spoiler alert for exam 3. It's not the ends of the molecules. All right. Let's see, and I just told you that. Okay, now one thing to keep in mind is in your chromosomes, we talked about them, some of them being relatively large DNA molecules that are associated with proteins. You do not have one strand of DNA the entire length of the chromosome that is template and one strand that's not template. Okay? You can have, here's the example here, in three genes, and they're telling you which one's the template strand for each gene. It's variable for each gene, which strand is template, which strand is not. But which strand serves as template determines which direction the molecule will be read. Okay, we've got 5 prime to 3 prime. The enzyme is going to go in a direction from 3 to 5 on the template strand. So if this is the template strand, that means that the polymerase will be going from left to right, and it will produce an RNA molecule. If, in this case, the top strand is the template strand, the enzyme will be going from right to left. Okay? So you can have genes that are essentially on opposite strands from each other on the same DNA fragment, but the direction of transcription is opposed. Okay, so not all transcription is going from left to right on your chromosome. You've got it going together. You've got it, in this case, this is called convergent transcription, where two genes are being transcribed towards each other. In this case, you've got divergent transcription, where they're being transcribed in opposite directions, basically back to back. It's a very common thing. I just don't want you to think about all the transcription on a single chromosome always being using the same strand as a template strand. That's not the case. All right. So we've got this information in the form of bases on DNA. To a certain extent, it's like a computer code. All we have is subtle little bits of information. We've got a 1 in 4 at each of these positions for nucleotides, and that's being converted to essentially the same information with a slightly different molecule, RNA instead of DNA. The analogy that I use for transcription is we're taking long-term information and we're converting it to a shorter-term, more mobile molecule. So it's like you taking a file off of the hard drive of your computer, putting it on a flash drive. Okay? If you lose your flash drive, it's not the end of the world. But if your hard drive crashes, that's a couple days and a lot of anxiety in your life to get that worked out. It's the job of RNA to be a disposable molecule within the cell. So we're taking this information that you want as long as the cell is alive, and we're converting it to something that you just want for a few hours or maybe a day or two. But it's the same information. When you move that file from your hard drive to the flash drive, it's the same information. It's just in a more disposable form, an easier, more portable form. Okay? But how do we determine where the bits of information are? When we talked about replicons, the unit of replication or a gene, that there are signals on the DNA, specific sequences that will recruit RNA polymerase that determines where the gene starts, where transcription will start. And there also will be sequences that will determine where they end. So there are really three phases to transcription that we're going to talk about today. Okay. So let me make sure that I'm using the same terminology that your book does. Yep, okay. Okay, initiation. And in initiation, we will recruit RNA polymerase to the DNA at a specific site. Okay, and I'm just going to shorten polymerase to poly up here, but be aware of the fact that I mean RNA polymerase. And initiation will arguably the biggest difference between prokaryotes and eukaryotes in terms of gene expression is how they carry out initiation. So we'll talk about that a little bit today. We'll talk about a little bit more when we talk about gene regulation. Much of gene regulation happens at this initiation stage. If you want a gene to be transcribed, you have to recruit RNA polymerase to that gene. RNA polymerase it's not a door-to-door salesman that just slides down. It's like, you guys need to be transcribed. Everybody good here? You not? I'm going to transcribe you anyway. Give me 5 minutes of your time. I'll transcribe you. You've got to stand out and wave down. It's a hitchhiker. Okay, genes are hitchhikers. You've got to flag down RNA polymerase to get attention. Right? Then the next is elongation. And that's the synthesis of the RNA molecule. And that will be complementary with an E, meaning that it's the ATCG, not complementary with an I. I'm too old to have a best friend, but my best friend and I say that we complement each other very well, but we rarely complement each other with an I. So complementary just means the ATGC kind of thing. Okay. And then there's termination. And that is RNA polymerase stops the synthesis and it dissociates or leaves the DNA, the template DNA strand. Okay. So we can break this down into these three phases. A lot of the talk today is going to be on initiation and termination. Elongation, it's just me and a roll of paper towel on the floor again, essentially, except I'm reaching out and grabbing ribo NTPs instead of DNTPs. All right. Now, in initiation, there are specific sequences on the DNA that direct it. Okay? And we've got terminology in genetics. Whenever there's a sequence or something is present in the actual DNA molecule that affects how it's regulated or how it's expressed, we refer to that as cis-acting. Okay? It's localized. It's got something to do with the actual DNA molecule that is being expressed. It's a cis-acting element. We refer to these as their promoters that are involved in initiation. And promoters are cis-acting elements that drive the initiation. They are specific sequences that either directly recruit RNA polymerase, in the case of bacteria, or recruit proteins that recruit RNA polymerase, in the case of eukaryotes. Okay? So promoters, we'll talk about them quite a bit, but promoters will always be upstream of the gene. Okay, so we need to talk a little bit about directionality in genes, and this is where 5% of you, your heads will explode because you just can't take stuff on board or things that I'm saying and think in terms of orientation. I apologize to you guys. Plug up your ears if you're one of those kind of people. All right. When we talked about the template strand and the non-template strand, what we will typically show is the sequence for the non-template strand because that's what the RNA will look like. Upstream means 5 prime of the non-template strand, more in the 5 prime orientation of the non-template strand. So this is upstream. This would be downstream, would be 3 prime of the non-template strand. Okay? Even though the RNA polymerase is not going to do a single thing with this strand except push it out of the way, we make these denotations based on the non-template strand. So upstream actually means here, if the RNA polymerase is going to move 3 prime to 5 prime along this template strand, upstream is 3 prime of the non-template strand, 5 prime is downstream. But we focus on the non-template strand. Okay? I'm sorry, I didn't come up with those rules, and I hated them when I learned them too. Okay, so the promoter will be upstream, and here's the other really annoying thing about the promoters. Okay, so the promoters will be upstream someplace. And we will give you the sequence of the promoter based on the non-template strand. Okay? So that's not the sequence that's being bound by RNA polymerase. The sequence that's being bound by RNA polymerase is actually the complementary sequence to the promoter sequences that I'm going to tell you. But don't learn the complements because no genetic student ever has. Because we always quiz you and test you on the sequences that aren't bound by the RNA polymerase. Okay? So that's the problem with template, non-template strand. It works out great for elucidating or predicting what the RNA molecule is going to look like, but it gives you an incorrect sense of what sequences RNA polymerase actually looks for. Okay? But the promoter will be upstream of a gene always. Okay? Because RNA polymerase can only move one direction. If you put the promoter downstream, RNA polymerase can't back up a few thousand nucleotides and then start moving downstream. So you always have to initiate upstream of the gene. Okay? So here's some parts of a gene. We've got the promoter. We'll talk about some of these specific sequences first. But the job of the promoter is to recruit RNA polymerase. It will come in here, it will bind, and it will start moving down the strand. Okay? The sequences and the promoter do not represent the first nucleotides transcribed. That's just a binding site. You need to get the RNA polymerase moving a little bit before you'll actually start transcribing. So there is another landmark, and I will typically, if I give you homework or test problems, I will typically either put a star above the transcription start site, or I'll give you the rules that you can find a transcription start site. But the first nucleotide, the 5' end of the RNA molecule, is referred to as the transcription start site. It's not in the promoter. It's generally considered then the first base outside of the promoter region. Okay. But that's still not necessarily part of the sequences that will be reflected in a protein. When we get to translation next week, that'll be a little bit clearer. But one of the general rules of thumb that if for some reason you're subjected to a Saul-like scenario in which you're kidnapped, you've got to identify a transcription start site or a chainsaw is going to like swing down from the ceiling. In a pinch, look for a CAT triplet and the A in the middle of a CAT triplet just downstream from a promoter is very often the transcription start site. Okay. All right. So, which means, since I told you we give you this information on the non-template strand, if this is a non-template strand, if this is the first nucleotide of a molecule, that you would have A would be the first nucleotide, U would be the second. Remember when you are looking at a non-template strand, if you're predicting what the RNA molecule is going to look like, you just take the non-template strand, write the same sequence, except you convert T's to U's. Okay. All right, then you've got the RNA coding region. That's where elongation takes place. Right? Then at the end, you've got a termination or a terminator with a termination site. Termination site is the last nucleotide added, and it's also where the RNA polymerase lets go of the template strand. So it works out pretty well that each of those three processes that we talked about is reflected by a structure of the gene. Promoter for initiation, RNA encoding region for elongation, and then terminator for termination or transcription termination site. Okay, so some of the things that we need raw material. And so you need ribonucleotides, RNTPs. The other day when I was doing replication, I was talking about that as an enzyme, I would stand on a nucleotide, look for its complement, reach out there, find a DNTP. Same thing is happening with RNA polymerase, except now when I reach out, I'm grabbing ribonucleotides instead of deoxyribonucleotides. RNA polymerase is specific for grabbing those ribonucleotides, whereas DNA polymerase is specific for grabbing those deoxyribonucleotides. Okay, it's what makes DNA polymerase different than RNA polymerase in the elongation phase. Otherwise, it's the same thing that's happening. If I'm standing on a C, I reach up and I grab a G. If I stand on a T for DNA, I reach up and grab an A. If I'm standing on an A, I reach up and grab a uracil. So the complement that the enzyme is standing on, or the base that the enzyme is attached to, determines what the appropriate complement is. That will be added to the growing 3' end of the RNA molecule. All right, so we're going to talk in terms of bacterial RNA polymerase for a while. Okay, much like replication, transcription was largely studied initially. The mechanism was elucidated in bacteria, and then the differences between bacteria and eukaryotes was determined. So much of it was done in bacteria. We refer to RNA polymerase as a holoenzyme. Okay. It just means that it has several component proteins that are needed to make it functional. Okay. And it's got two copies of the alpha unit, a single copy of beta, a copy of beta prime. Depends on which bacteria you're talking about. Okay. I just want you to know there are multiple proteins that come together. Okay. That it is a holoenzyme. It's a complex enzyme made up of multiple proteins. But the one part that I want you to know is sigma factor. Okay. Because sigma is the big difference between the way that bacteria do things and the way that you do things inside of your cells. Okay? And sigma is the factor that binds the promoter. Okay? So you've got RNA polymerase. All of these parts are functional and structural for elongation and termination. But sigma is the one factor that determines whether the molecule binds to a promoter or not. Okay. And what happens is that there have been a lot of studies done. You get some that point towards one event happening sooner than the other. Most suggest that it's a spontaneous event. So RNA polymerase, the core enzyme, if you ever hear reference to the core RNA polymerase, that's everything but sigma is what that means. And so sigma kind of has its own thing going on. You've got all those other subunits that are together as the enzyme, and it's floating along. And what will happen is sigma factor will associate with RNA polymerase and bind a promoter. There was some question as to whether sigma binds to the promoter first and then the RNA polymerase binds, or whether sigma binds to the RNA polymerase molecule first and then the whole thing binds to promoter. Most studies suggest that it's basically a spontaneous process, that the three of them come together at the same time. Okay. However, it helps you to think about it. What I want you to know is that sigma factor is the part of the enzyme that binds to it, and that this unit is not functional unless sigma tells it where to bind. This thing will float around for its entire life as a molecule and never bind DNA unless it associates with sigma. And sigma is what determines what sequences it binds. Okay. Now, one of the advantages to this for a bacterium is, remember, bacteria are, fast, cheap, simple, that they want very few moving parts. They want things to happen quickly without a lot of energy invested in them. So if you produce an RNA polymerase and you basically need one protein to help you find the promoters, that's fairly efficient. The way that bacteria will determine Gene expression is by the sequences on the DNA. What eukaryotes will do is stick a bunch of proteins on a promoter that then will kind of grab the RNA polymerase. You don't have the ability to regulate quite a sophisticated fashion with prokaryotes, but this is very few parts needed, and you can do a pretty good job of this. Okay? So sigma factor recognizes the promoter, it binds to the RNA polymerase, and you get initiation. And now you've got all of the parts needed. The RNA polymerase is bound. We talked about A's and T's, the fact that they only make two hydrogen bonds. G's and C's make three hydrogen bonds, so it's easier to peel apart DNA that have a lot of A's and T's. It's 50% less energy to peel them apart. The first thing that has to happen for transcription to start after the enzyme set down, when we actually start, the enzyme starts carrying out its function, it has to peel apart the two strands so we could read the template strand. So when we talk about these promoter sequences, we will frequently see AT-rich sequences as the promoters, just because energetically it's more favorable to unzip DNA that's AT as opposed to DNA that's GC. Okay? The strands are separated, and then this enzyme will go through, leave an area where the strands are separated. It will read the template strand, produce the RNA molecule, and it slides along. And the enzyme will physically slide along the strand, the template strand. All right, so what this is showing is DNA molecules that are being transcribed. And so each one of these branch points is an RNA polymerase that's producing RNA, and then you can see the RNA molecules coming off. And actually, these clusters that you see at the end look like they're ribosomes. So this is probably a bacterial system in which transcription and translation take place at the same time. You've got RNA being produced, and then you've got ribosomes bound to the RNA that are producing proteins. But we're going to focus on one RNA polymerase comes in. Notice, it's kind of a pastel-shaded oval. I warned you about this stuff. And DNA is stretched out tight, so it's nice and straight. So how can this molecule not help but slide efficiently down this? It doesn't work that way in nature. This is the way it's always presented. And we think it's got its leisurely trip. What you don't know is if this gene is an important gene, there will be other RNA polymerase molecules right on this one's ass, pushing it along, that you will just get initiation after initiation after initiation at these sites. We try to give it to you guys in a lower stress environment. We're just focused on one RNA polymerase. It's cool. It's chill. It's not the way life works. I know, and it's creepy to hear an old guy use that terminology, isn't it? So you're lucky I didn't go, holla. But now you're not so lucky, are you? Anyway. All right, so bacterial promoters. There are two areas upstream. And when we talk about how far upstream they are, we're talking about upstream from that first nucleotide, upstream from the transcription start site. Okay? And the first, arguably the more important of the two, is the minus 10 sequence. And it gets that name because it's approximately 10 base pairs upstream of the transcription start site. Okay. There are some other names for it, depending on if you want to name them after the scientist. Some books you'll see it called the Pribnow site. I'll always refer to it as the minus 10. And this is the, it will typically be AT-rich. And Pribnow box is referred to more in eukaryotic promoters. But the consensus sequence. Consensus means if we look at all bacteria, there's some variation in their preferred promoter. But the one that does the best job of binding to most sigma factors is the sequence TATAAT. This is 5 prime, 3 prime. So this is the non-template strand. Right. So that means the template strand would be ATATTA. Don't learn this. This is the sequence I want you to know, because if you are only given one strand of information, it will be the non-template strand. So we look for TATAAT. Okay. In eukaryotes, or in occasionally in prokaryotes, sometimes this is referred to as the TATA box because you have TATA in them. But the idea, the minimal number of hydrogen bonds holding these two strands together, so it's pretty easy to start separating the DNA here. That's at the minus 10 sequence. But if you learn this sequence, you're in good shape. Okay? Now, if you make slight variations in these sequences, you decrease the efficiency of binding this promoter by the sigma factor. Okay? So you could swap out a T here for an A here. This will still act as a promoter, but now it's not quite as strong as it was with the consensus sequence. TATAAT is the maximal strength bacterial promoter. Okay? When you start throwing in G's and C's, then you start dropping the efficiency even more, because then sigma's not recognizing it, and it requires more energy to start separating these strands. Okay. If I give you anything in class, it's either going to be the consensus or something close enough to the consensus. If it's not obvious to you, I'll underline the dang thing. Okay, so you know it. All right, then the next area is the minus 35. And minus 35, so it's 35, approximately 35 base pairs upstream of the transcription start site. And that's the location where let's go back here. If we think about sigma factor binds at one end of the polymerase molecule, and it recognizes a strong minus 10, that minus 35 sort of helps stabilize the association with enzyme with the template strand. And so it's a little bit further upstream. The vast majority of initiation is driven by the minus 10 sequence, not the minus 35. Minus 35 does have some effect, but it's we're going to focus on minus 10 here. But there is a consensus sequence for minus 35 as well. And it's TTGACA. Right? But if you got to choose one or the other, much more important in your life to understand the minus 10 sequences. Okay, so here we're showing the promoter regions. Both of these sequences, though, are considered part of the promoter. Okay, so here in yellow, we've got the promoter. It's always going to be upstream. And we've got our minus 10, we've got our minus 35. And about 10 bases downstream from the minus 10 will be that first nucleotide transcribed. And from that point on, you just start adding the next nucleotide onto the 3' end. So initiation takes place at the promoter, and once we start transcribing this, at that point we've entered elongation of the process. Okay. So the question about what binds to the minus 10, it's the holoenzyme, which includes sigma factor. If you don't have sigma, it doesn't. Sigma won't bind it alone. That it's a simultaneous event. All right. So in initiation, you don't need the RNTPs. All right, so all those ribonucleotides that are floating around out there, we don't need those. All we're doing is getting the enzyme connected to the template DNA strand. Okay, so now we're going to weave initiation. We will talk about specifics of initiation. We'll have an entire lecture on it down the road when we talk about how it's regulated up and down. Much of that takes place in initiation, so we'll revisit initiation soon. Okay. Elongation is when the RNA polymerase is just doing its regular activity of sliding down the template strand and polymerizing that molecule. Those of you that were here for the replication lecture, you got my impersonation of a DNA polymerase molecule. In your mind, just relive those moments, and I don't have to stand here again and walk along. There's no discontinuous transcription, so it's much easier. It's just the initiates, and it walks this way, and it just keeps polymerizing. There's no Okazaki fragment equivalent in transcription. It initiates, it goes one direction all the time, and it just grabs the complement to the template strand and adds that to the 3' end of the RNA molecule that it's producing, and it always keeps a hold of that growing molecule. Okay? The RNA molecule is not floating out here freely. It always has a hold just next to the 3' end of the growing molecule, so when it reaches out, grabs the complementary base, it attaches, makes that phosphodiester linkage, and then it slides down one and it moves its grip down one so that now the new 3' end is what's hanging out. So as the RNA polymerase is moving down the DNA molecule, the RNA molecule itself is starting to string out behind the enzyme. Okay? And that's how you get that picture that we had with these RNA molecules coming out from the enzymes. The enzymes are moving along this DNA strand. And in most of these, you can kind of tell. You've got shorter RNA molecules coming off here, right? These aren't as long, and then you go and it's longer, longer, longer. So I could tell that this is the level, or this is the direction of transcription. It initiates someplace around here, and then elongation takes place in this direction, because you get longer RNA molecules the further along the gene that the RNA polymerase has moved. Okay. So that's elongation. If you have questions about it, you can swing by my office, bounce me emails, but it's very much like it was in replication with grabbing the complement. Okay, then we'll talk about termination. Well, hang on a sec. There's one thing I wanted. Let me see. Okay. I want to make sure that eukaryotes get a little love on the initiation side at some point. Okay. Termination. There are two main forms of termination. And I'll just let you know that I have probably never laughed more in my life grading than I did the last time I asked about termination. Because people memorize one of these things. And so, two forms of termination and transcription, row independent, row dependent. And I will go into some details here in a few minutes, just so you're warned, to talk about the specific mechanisms of these. And then I ask college students about the mechanistic differences between row-dependent and row-independent. And 60% of the class would say row-dependent requires row, row-independent does not. That's not really a college-level answer, so I will warn you now, don't do that. My hair's already bad enough. When I grade exams, when I see bad answers, I tend to like, oh, my God. At the end of a really bad question, I got this alfalfa thing that happens because my hair is not really thick and coarse, so a little pressure goes a long way with my hair. And it's just standing straight up, and I will walk out into the lab, and my students go, ooh, it's not going well, is it? So don't give me grading head on termination. Okay? There is row independent, and no, it doesn't require row, and row dependent, and yes, it does, but there's a lot more to that story. Okay? But both of them involve cis-acting components of the DNA. Okay? That when we showed you that gene, we showed you, there was a promoter upstream, there was the encoding region, and there's a termination. The termination sequences are important, and they're important because they tend to make hairpin structures. So they will make a loop. Okay? So with row independent, you get a large termination loop. See here? So we've got, this is showing row independent. Okay? So we'll talk about it first. And what you look for is a relatively large loop followed by a string of uracils. So that means on the DNA there will be a string of A's that will produce a string of uracils on the RNA molecule. And DNA is double-stranded, so it's not really the stem loop forming on the DNA, it's the stem loop forming on the RNA that's being produced. So the enzyme is going through here, it's producing these sequences in the RNA, and then as it slides down, okay, remember the enzyme keeps a hold of the molecule for a while. After the enzyme gets a little bit past that region, that RNA molecule, you've got those reactive base pairs that want to form complements. Their complements are right next to them on the strand, and so they form this stem loop structure. Okay, so you've got this stem loop structure. I want you to think about a stem loop structure immediately coming off of a RNA polymerase as a structure that gooses the enzyme. Okay? The enzyme's going along, it's doing that thing that I was doing earlier, all of a sudden a stem loop structure forms, it's like, whoa! Okay? And that's basically what happens. That stem loop structure bumps the back end of the enzyme and it causes it to pause for just a little bit. And it pauses, now it's made all of these uracils. The uracils are across from adenines. We've got the RNA equivalent, RNA-DNA equivalent of AT pairing. We've got AU pairing. It's very easy for these two molecules to dissociate because the minimal number of base pair or of hydrogen bonds are being formed between these. So we goose the enzyme with this termination structure, the stem loop, and there's not much keeping the RNA to the DNA at this point. So the enzyme is like, all right, screw this stuff. I'm not getting goosed by stem loops and going about my job. That's row independent. I did not talk about anything called row other than to tell you I didn't talk about anything called row with this. It's just the structure of the RNA molecule dislodges the RNA polymerase. Okay. Now here's row dependent. And there will be a stem loop. Okay. And the stem loop will do a job, but not to the same extent. Okay, the stem loop structures in row dependent tend to be smaller. Okay, and you don't necessarily have the polyuracil. Okay, but what happens with row dependent? Is there's a protein called Rho. Okay? And Rho binds to RNA molecules that are being expressed as they're being produced. Okay? So after I've started elongation as an enzyme, I've got this RNA molecule that's floating out there, Rho binds to it. And Rho starts moving along the RNA molecule. Okay? And Rho moves slightly faster along RNA than I do along DNA. So Rho is gradually catching up with me. It's not moving along the DNA. It's moving along that RNA molecule that I produced. But Rho's kind of catching up to me. Then what happens is I get to this part of the termination sequence where I produce a stem loop structure. It bumps my backside a little bit, but that slows me down. Okay? And it slows me down enough so that if Rho has caught up with me, when I make that stem loop structure and Rho is there, it just won't slow me down. It will actually bump me off of the DNA. So Rho is running, 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 and then Rho gets to that stem loop structure that would normally slow me down and goose me a little bit. But the fact that rho was there, that causes me to terminate, to quit. Okay? So with rho dependent, it's not only cis acting agent with the DNA sequence, it's what we refer to as a transacting. You need another protein involved, and rho is that other protein. But rho binds to the RNA, not the DNA. Keep that in mind. And in both cases, the stem loop structures that form are on the RNA, not the DNA that's serving as a template. Okay? But both of them serve the same role, and that is they cause transcription to stop, and they dislodge the RNA polymerase from the template strand. All right, so that's the way that it happens in prokaryotes. And now we'll talk about some of the differences in the way that eukaryotes do things. The vast majority of differences that we will focus on are at initiation. Okay? I commented that bacteria like doing things with very few moving parts, and we've got this consensus sequence, and if there are changes in the sequence, that affects how initiation takes place and how frequently initiation takes place. The closer to that consensus sequence that we are, the more rapidly transcription will be initiated. The further away from this consensus sequence, the less often it will happen. Okay? So it's very much driven by the promoter sequences in prokaryotes. Sigma is the only molecule that really binds to it. Okay? What eukaryotes do is the DNA sequences don't recruit RNA polymerase directly. That instead what they do is they build up it's called a transcription complex or initiation complex. I think I can erase this now. We don't need it anymore. Okay. And the initiation complex are several proteins, in some cases dozens of proteins. And then they recruit, these proteins recruit RNA polymerase. Okay. Let's see if we got nice pictures. Okay. And when we talk about gene expression, we'll talk about more component parts of this initiation complex. But it's an indirect thing that you get a large number of proteins that will come in and bind to the sequences. You still have, at the core promoter, we're still looking at an AT-rich area. Okay, and we still see TATA being very common. The spacing is different between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. Don't focus on those. I want you to know the prokaryote spacing of minus 10, minus 35. But I want you to understand that the role of being an AT-rich region is the same for both of them. It makes it easier to peel the strands apart and start reading the template strand. But in eukaryotes, instead of just sigma and the polymerase, you will have multiple proteins that will bind to the promoter region, and then they will recruit RNA polymerase to the promoter region. It's just not sigma and the polymerase binding to a sequence. So it's much more dependent on these proteins to form the initiation complex. There are different RNA polymerase molecules depending on what class of RNA that we're producing. So in eukaryotes, there's one that's specific for messenger RNA. It's called RNA polymerase 2. And it recognizes certain initiation complexes that are upstream of genes that are going to produce mRNA molecules. You don't see that in prokaryotes. Prokaryotes, you've got one RNA polymerase molecule, but you've got different sigmas. So for the vast majority of a bacterial cell's life, it will just produce one type of sigma. But if you start stressing a bacterium, it expresses a new sigma, a different sigma that then looks for different promoters. So if you heat up E. coli, get it where it's warm, it goes into what we call heat shock, and it tries to survive that, and it needs to transcribe genes at different levels. It wouldn't do that with the same sigma. So there's a heat shock sigma that binds to the enzyme, and it starts producing more proteins that it needs to survive at higher temperatures. That regulation takes place by switching sigma factors. With eukaryotes, they use different RNA polymerases for different types of RNA being produced. And then in eukaryotes, promoters are much more complex than they are in prokaryotes. That you can have, remember, because we're binding multiple proteins to these things, and so you need to have sequences that those proteins will interact with. Okay, proteins that bind DNA just don't do so based on the shape of DNA, because DNA is spaced the same that they would just bind the entire length of DNA. They have to be sequence specific. So depending on the bases that are present, they will come in and bind. Okay, so that means with eukaryotes, since we're binding so many proteins in here, we have to have room for those sequences. And so here we're showing different eukaryotic promoters and that you've got different types of regulatory boxes. Here's the TATA boxes. This is a viral SV40. It's short for simian virus 40. It's a virus that can infect great apes and humans. And it doesn't have a true TATA box. It's viral, so it plays by slightly different rules. But it's got all these different regulatory or control elements present in them. They're called GC boxes. They will be bound by a specific protein that initiates transcription. Here we've got a gene for thymidine kinase, and it's got a true TATA box. It's got those GC regions, but it also has CAT boxes and an OCT box. Each one of these is bound by another type of protein that helps build these initiation complexes. So there's much more diversity, much more complexity to eukaryotic promoters since you're recruiting different proteins rather than just the RNA polymerase. Then the last thing that we'll really talk about with respect to eukaryotic promoters is that there are other regions outside of the promoters called enhancers. Okay? So these are independent of the promoters, but they're sequences on DNA that will increase the rate of transcription of a gene on that same fragment of DNA. The thing about enhancers is that they can be really far away from the gene that they're affecting. Okay? They don't have to be immediately upstream like a promoter. So that's how we distinguish an enhancer from a promoter. Enhancers won't work without a gene having a promoter. They have to have their normal promoter, but then an enhancer will always increase the rate of transcription at a gene. Okay? And the way they do it is by interacting with the initiation complex at that site. And we'll talk about it more when we get to gene expression, but it involves you not thinking in terms of DNA as being stretched out in a straight line on a page. Right? And then again, with eukaryotes, we've got different designation of RNA polymerase. You're not gonna see that in here. All right. So here's just a picture of the enhancer showing what's happening. Here are all these proteins in the initiation complex. The way that an enhancer can work is by DNA looping. Okay. Here's the enhancer sequence. This is upstream of the promoter. We start forming this initiation complex, but then the enhancer is bound by an activator protein. Activator proteins help recruit RNA polymerase. The DNA loops around, and this recruits RNA polymerase at a higher level than if we don't have this looping with the activator playing a part. So you've got the normal initiation complex that would recruit at a certain level, But now if you throw an enhancer in nearby that could loop around and interact, then you get a higher level of transcription. But you could have thousands of bases in between the promoter and the enhancer. It just depends on how big that loop is going to be. Right? We're not going to go into it a lot right now, but I need you to start thinking in terms of nucleic acids as molecules that can loop around and interact with themselves, as opposed to just always stretched out tight and straight, and the 5' end is here, the 3' end is here, and nothing ever interacts with each other. We're going to start talking in terms of lariats and loops and situations like that. Okay, elongation is the same as in prokaryotes. And then with termination, just know row and row independent with prokaryotes. We'll get you out of the eukaryotic system and termination. All right? Okay, so remember, there will be homework online, but it's not due until next Thursday, so you don't even have to look at it until after the test if you choose not to.